This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Last week, the federal government released thousands of documents related to the assassination of John F. Kennedy in 1963. As researchers continue to comb through the files, questions linger about an alleged call Lee Harvey Oswald tried to make after his arrest. According to a government report in the 1970s, Oswald wanted to call a man named John Hurt in Raleigh, North Carolina, when Oswald was in a Dallas jail. That call was never completed. So who is John Hurt? Why did Lee Harvey Oswald want to talk to him? And why didn't the authorities let it go through? My guest today has been on a decades-long mission to answer those questions. Grover Proctor is a former professor of statistics who lives in Cary, and he joins me now. Grover Proctor, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
Let's talk about this Raleigh call now. Set the scene for us. Dallas jail. Lee Harvey Oswald has been arrested. Tell us about this phone call.
It was late at night, about 10:30, and the lady from whom we get all the information really that we know about what happened in the telephone switchboard room that night had come on her shift just a little bit early to relieve someone, and she was told by her associate that it was still working there, that she'd been told that Oswald was going to attempt to make a call and that two men would be coming in to listen to the call and just to alert her that that was going to happen. Mm. Sure enough, two men came down a little later. They were put into a utility room right next to it where they could listen in. And in a few minutes, Oswald picked up the phone and called down, got the switchboard. And both ladies plugged in at the same time, so both were able to hear Oswald say the name of the person, the area code, and two telephone numbers that he had memorized for John Hurt in Raleigh, North Carolina. The lady who would tell us what went on allowed the first lady to actually place the call or to carry on doing the call. She put Oswald on hold, picked up the other key, and talked to the two men that had come in. And as she sat there and listened to whatever it was that those two men said, she got visibly more nervous, stopped talking to them, sat there, got her composure, turned the key back on to Oswald and said, "I'm sorry, sir, the call didn't answer," without ever having attempted to make the call, leaving the assumption that whatever was said to her by those two men was, "Don't attempt to make the call."
Who were the two men?
Never identified, though they were people from the Dallas Police Department that these two ladies knew had said to the older lady who was in charge that they knew what was going to happen and these two men would come in. They were dressed in street clothes, and both women said that they knew that they were not part of the police department there because they knew everybody that worked there.
Okay, so for whatever reason, the call doesn't go through. Do we know that it's an actual working number? What do we know about this phone number?
We know several things about it. Yes, it was a working number. When the House Assassinations Committee was given information about this, they leapt on it, and they actually did quite a bit of research, which for most of the 70s and 80s was all we knew about it. And they had identified the fact through talking to the telephone company here that those two numbers went to two different men in Raleigh, North Carolina, both of whom were named John Hurt. But they said, the telephone company said to the House Assassinations Committee researchers that those numbers were unlisted and really they shouldn't be telling them those names. I didn't think that was particularly appropriate thing to say because Oswald or somebody had to have gotten those numbers somehow. And what made sense to me, if they were both registered to men named John Hurt, was that somebody, somewhere, sometime, for some reason, said to Oswald, "If you ever get in trouble, call John Hurt in Raleigh and he'll contact us and we'll take care of you." That, we found out later from the CIA itself, was standard operational spycraft. That's what he would have done had he been working for as an agent or a non-operative correspondent for the CIA or any other agency. And so I figured someone had to have called information, what we now call directory assistance, to get numbers for John Hurt. So I was away from home at the time and living in a different area, so I had my parents go to the Raleigh Olivia Rainey Library and look up to find those two numbers to see if they really were published in 1963, and they were. So then I expanded it, and they were published for 2 years, at least, and I only checked 2 years back and 2 years forward. There was never a time when they were non-published, and we're not sure why the phone company gave that information. So, yes, they were real, valid working numbers, and that number worked all the way up to when I called and talked to John Hurt in summer of 1980. So it was a valid number.
So who's John Hurt?
John Hurt, well, there was two. One was pretty much gotten out of the way as a consideration to begin with. He was a teenager, a high school dropout, and was working in the tire recapping business at the time. Didn't seem to have much interest, especially when we found out that the second man was a former counterintelligence agent for the Army in World War II. Had a law degree from the University of Virginia, and though he never practiced it, his time with the Army in World War II was so successful that when the war was finished, they offered him a commission to stay on and make a career. He turned that down, came back to the Carolinas, and ultimately settled in Raleigh and did some insurance investigation work for the Department of Insurance.
So this is fascinating because just whoever these two individuals are, they did not want this phone call to go through.
Apparently. And my guess is if we accept the fact that strings were being pulled and that Oswald had, in fact, been working with other people who were monitoring or directing his movements, and I realize not everybody accepts that. There are people who definitely and intellectually believe that Oswald acted alone, and so this is not going to make sense to them. But if we do believe, as the House Assassination Committee told us was the case, that there was probably a conspiracy to kill the president, then whoever it was he was working with probably, and this is my guess, probably didn't want there to be actually a physical record of a phone call going from the Dallas jail to Raleigh, North Carolina, that could be traced back. They had no idea at that time that the other lady working in the switchboard room that night would make notes about those telephone numbers and all that information, would store it away, and later share it with the FBI after about 5 years.
After about 5 years, this is important. A couple of things you said. House Assassinations Committee in the 1970s does finally conclude that it most likely was a conspiracy. So,
yes.
So if you are of the belief that it was a lone gunman, the preponderance of evidence is against you at the moment. At least the official word on the assassination is it is most likely a conspiracy. And then kind of who was involved, nobody knows, that, at least the Assassinations Committee. But that this doesn't come up until that investigation. The Warren Commission doesn't see any of this, though the documentation was available. And somebody didn't want to hear a conversation that the accused assassin of the president was going to have with an outside individual. Why not?
Well, and again, that's the only reason I can come up with the theory is that the attempt to try to keep a actual physical phone record from having been in the area of Dallas to Raleigh was more important to them than actually being able to hear what he would say. And if, in fact, they were pulling his strings, they knew what he was going to say, and that is, I'm a patsy. He'd been saying it the whole time he was arrested. They're giving me all of these accusations of killing a policeman and killing the president. I didn't do it. And here's the people that know that I didn't do it. Contact them. They wouldn't want anybody hearing that.
Yeah, and of course, then nobody from the official investigation, at least the Warren Commission, contacted John Hurt, as far as you know, did they?
The Warren Commission never knew anything about the Raleigh call because Mrs. Treon, she's the lady that had written down the information and all of the phone numbers and area code and all of that, she actually just wrote that down as what she called a souvenir of having worked that night in the Dallas jail, took it home, put it in her files, and it wasn't until 5 years later when she was, by that time she and her husband had moved to Missouri, she and her husband were having dinner with one of their friends, and she said, well, you know, and a strange thing happened. She did not seek publicity. It was not a situation of she thought she knew more than the people who were doing the investigation. She wasn't after fame. She certainly was not after money, but she just told the story. That person then went told the Greene County Sheriff. Sheriff said, I think the FBI ought to know, and that's how the ball got rolling.
You've been at this for somewhere around 40 years, at least investigating this, and other aspects of the assassination as well, or just this?
Initially, what I did and the things that I reported were of the standpoint of what is the investigation out there, what is it doing, who are the people that involved, what are the theories that are going on. So kind of acting as a historian and as a critic, as you were, of the critics, while all at the same time learning as much as I could. And then when I discovered that 919 area code was involved with a call that Oswald wanted to make, I call my editor, Bernie Reeves, at Spectator Magazine, and I said, do you want me to investigate it? And that was in 1980. He said yes. We worked together on it for the rest of that summer, and it really sort of snowballed from there. And it for my research, eclipsed everything else I'd been working on.
Well, the easy part, in a sense, if you really are serious about investigating that assassination, then the easy part is realizing that it had to be a conspiracy when you look at all the evidence and really weigh it objectively. Hard part is figuring out who's involved, and nobody can do that. And that's sometimes where theorists run afoul of public opinion, because they'll try to stitch together a conspiracy theory that adds names, and then it gets a little harder to prove.
Right. They want something to be the case. And so every piece of evidence that they find, if it tends to support their pet theory, they'll include it. If it doesn't, yeah. Oh, well, that's just the CIA making that up. That's a bogus document or whatever. And I've seen it happen. And I've seen some absolutely bizarre conspiracy theories thrown out there seriously and by people who want them to be taken seriously, and they're just garbage.
Do you think that we'll ever, I mean, again, that there's a conspiracy is established, but do you ever think we'll get to the bottom of it and figure out who was involved?
I'm less sanguine about that now than I used to be. What I used to say to my audiences was, say, in the 80s, well, there are still people alive who would have been involved, who might have been involved. There may be a deathbed confession. There could be someone's diary that gets discovered. Somebody could be arrested for some other thing and say, well, I can give you this if you'll reduce in my sentence to that or whatever. And that seemed plausible and logical. I mean, I had watched all the TV mystery movies, and I thought that was exactly what would happen, but it hasn't.
Lots more documents now. We'll stay in touch, but thank you so much for joining us today. My guest is Grover Proctor. He's a researcher who has studied the JFK assassination for decades, and he talked about the alleged phone call that Lee Harvey Oswald tried to make from a Dallas jail after the assassination. Coming up, stories at the crossroads of medicine and religion on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay tuned.